Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I am very pleased to welcome our special guest for this session, Gavin Sirat, ex-Strikead, Millennial Media, OpenX, general programmatic ad tech aficionado is how I'm going to introduce you, Gavin.
Thank you.
Good welcome.
Morning. How are we doing?
And yeah, very well, thank you. It's great to have you on the podcast for the first time, unbelievably.
Yeah.
And also big hello to Lindsay over there in, as I keep referring to it, the Waltham So Studios.
Hello from the Waltham So Studio. And contrasting to last week where we were stifling hot and wilting, Rachel this week is sitting on a hot water bottle. So that tells you.
A little bit of a change in temperature. What can I say? Keeps us on our toes. At least I've not got bugs flying around my head. Lindsay's a little paranoid of the old. Yeah, so at least you can close the window today, right?
Yeah, and not die from closing the window. Yeah, it's making things much better.
The joys of working from home. Right, launching into the first story I wanted to chat with you guys about. So this is some news that TikTok are releasing, actually a couple of new ad formats. The one in particular that I was focusing in on here for this story is their augmented reality ad format, which they're going to be calling AR Brand Effect. And the idea behind it is that users will be able to add an interactive visual to their videos, which will be supplied by the advertiser. So I guess we're looking at something that's, you know, in my opinion, perhaps that sort of step beyond brand placement, because it's actually going to enable the sort of video creator to add the visual, and it's quite possibly going to have an interactive element to it for whoever's viewing the video as well. So it's expected to launch, I think, in Q3. And it's I suppose, not necessarily news in terms of an augmented reality ad format, because similar platforms, the likes of Snap and Instagram, have both got AR-enabled advertising functions as well. But it's quite interesting to just consider this from both an advertiser side and also a user side, given that TikTok is, you know, growing massively as a business. They're very aggressively pushing forward their advertising sort of opportunities. So I think it's quite interesting to imagine where this might be taking us. So you can imagine that the sort of upside for advertisers is fairly obvious. They'd get an opportunity to see their products in a 3D environment and format, and something that potentially holds the user's interest for a little bit longer with an interactive element to it. And you can also see that it might be the sort of thing, particularly on a platform that's already known for interactivity, it might be something that's engaged with quite heavily by TikTok users, notwithstanding the potential demographic of users on the TikTok platform. So I'm interested to hear your opinions on this. Do you think it's something that is going to be taken up widely by advertisers? Do you think it's something that's going to help push the TikTok platform's advertising proposition forward? Might it also be something that helps to perhaps change a little bit, shift and grow their classic demographic into something a bit more mainstream and with a slightly sort of, you know, wider age range and demographic? What do you think it's going to do for their business? Gavin, over to you.
I mean, it's kind of a funny one to give an opinion on, because I'm kind of I slightly conflicted. Like, there's a bit of me. I really like kind of the idea of, you know, more engaging ad formats and ad formats that consumers can play with and dig into a product and explore it. You know, that's something that we've done with rich media formats on desktop and on mobile for, you know, well over a decade. So it sounds cool. I'm not necessarily your typical user of TikTok or Snap, and I haven't ever seen an AR ad on any of these platforms. I'm not a heavy user of any of them, but to me, and I don't know how many advertisers are running AR ads on the likes of Instagram, it sort of feels to me like AR has never really achieved what it set out to do. Mm. And I'm not sure if there's something to do with just the device and the small screen. Mm. You know, there does seem to be a push, you know, as we said, Instagram and Snap, and definitely people who seem to use it a lot when they do like the mask things on their face. And you've got the likes of Google, who are returning AR animal search results. If you search for tiger on your phone, then it will give you the option to generate an AR tiger and put it into your living room. So like, big brands are pushing it. I think the really interesting thing is going to be Apple are kind of rumored to be launching Glass later this year. And I kind of think that AR really might come into its own if you've got a really good experience like that, as opposed to on your small screen. I do like the idea for advertisers, but I don't know. I don't have too much of an understanding of how widely used it is currently on the platforms it's available on.
Have you not got some teenagers in the house there, Gavin, to sort
they're
of help
under
you out
here with some we're not like onto any of these platforms for another couple of years.
Yeah, then you'll be an expert. Yeah,
I do have TikTok. I'm not sure where AR would go in that, but I'm not very good on TikTok. It's a bit like Snap. I kind of know roughly how to slide about on it, but I don't, you know, I find that whatever way you slide the screen, something happens and I just find it confusing. I'm much more at home on Facebook.
Classic demo, classic. We're not exactly the classic demographic for any of these platforms, except Lindsay, come on, millennial, help us out here. You're a big TikTok user, surely.
I mean, old millennial, just want to clarify that. True. So I'm old millennial. I am about as clueless as Gavin is. And I do, again, have TikTok. I've just about worked out how to use it, let alone record something on it. But because of that, though, like my first viewpoint was I read that. I had to go and do a bit of digging because I, from my limited use of TikTok, I was like, well, they already do AR ads, not AR ads, but they already do AR filters on TikTok, so what is the difference of this one? And of course my first thought was to Snapchat and talking about advertisers engaging with Snapchat. And I do remember when it first came out, the cost was a massive barrier to entry, and one of the most popular ones was Mountain Dew, I believe, and what you're able to do was actually have a bucket of Mountain Dew pouring over your head as a Snapchat filter, and that was really popular and that was great for Mountain Dew as from a brand perspective. So I kind of thought, well, actually from a TikTok perspective that would work really well, because if brands are happy to use their brands in that kind of fun, playful way for the right target audience, it could work really well. But actually this TikTok thing, and it doesn't surprise me because we're talking about China here, so in terms of their advancements versus a lot of the Western brands, they you know, they're streets ahead when it comes to this kind of stuff. This will be a little bit more like what you can do with Pokemon Go. So it's not just interacting with you and your head and your hands, interacting with things around you. So a BMW could like drive across the kitchen table behind you in one of your videos. So it's actually interacting with objects, house objects around you, which I think is very interesting because it just opens up the breadth of what a brand can do with a TikTok video so much more than just having something that can interact with a physical person. So I think it's quite interesting and exciting. And Gavin, I agree with you about the how much can you really do with a mobile versus actually the prospect of something like an Apple Glass, you know, the Google Glass and VR headsets in general. But I also think that the young folk, they are so much more used to doing everything on a mobile that for them that would be absolutely perfect. It's just how can a brand learn how to engage best with a user on that mobile, with the mobile experience? Because the kids get it, but the people that are trying to target the kids don't always get it. I think that's the thing that I'm trying to understand the most. But also, TikTok is, I don't actually know what the current demographic of TikTok is, but if it is still quite young, are any of these brands going to be interested in that level of engagement on an audience that is maybe a little bit too young for them?
Definitely BMW won't be.
No.
Well, you say that now, but now they've got the idea of having a AR ad with a car driving across the kitchen table. You know, things are about to change, aren't they? But I mean, I was recently thinking that the demographic of TikTok users has got to be changing, I think, quite significantly, especially during this sort of pandemic crisis, because people are being glued to their mobiles much more. And just simply because I'm seeing TikTok videos and ads in places that I never did before, and I'm thinking, well, if I'm seeing them, it means everyone else is. I'm quite sure that age demographic is increasing, and that's widening and opening up their opportunities. And that was going to be my next question, is do we think the technology is there yet? What would the experience be like, drawing on what you first mentioned there, Gavin? And I wonder if what we need is somebody to start using it, because often this is how these things get best discovered, is somebody uses it, you know, an influencer or someone uses it in a certain environment, and it just seems to, you know, sort of strike a chord, video goes viral, and then everybody starts to see what the potential opportunities are. And then in general, the tech gets modified to kind of cater for how users are actually interacting with it or adopting it. And I wonder if I wonder if that is what will happen here, because like you say, you know, the majority of people that are using TikTok are much more used to interacting on mobile devices, and they will have a completely different lens through which they notice and see products, and that will give advertisers ideas once they see how they're interacting with it, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. Just before I answer that, just going back to like the point about TikTok and users, I do think one of the things that I've noticed through lockdown is that the TikTok platform seems to be really good at sharing content out into other platforms, much better than others where it's a much less seamless experience. So I think that will do wonders for kind of widening the demographic usage of their platform, because if you're not installing it because your friends haven't told you to, because you're not 15, but you are seeing it appear in your Twitter feed, then, you know, it is going to encourage more usage. And there is good content in there. And they have been advertising pretty heavily over this period. So I would imagine that the demographic range will be wider than maybe we're joking that it is.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, the challenge that I think that anyone faces with AR, and, you know, even taking the point that, you know, the youth are used to using their mobile devices and are mobile natives, I always think, you know, the company that has been amazing at changing consumer behavior en masse has been Apple. You know, there have been things that they have done in the past where, you know, the iView's been around for a while, but it needed to kind of be baked into the operating system and made really easy for it to work. I think Apple Pay might be one of these examples where before that there were means of kind of using NFC to make a payment, but it never really hit on until Apple built a wallet and just made it a really seamless experience. I think, you know, it's interesting that Apple launched an AR toolkit in 2017. And, you know, that's, it's not quite the same, but it doesn't really feel like it's kind of hit the masses and been adopted as widely. I think the opportunity maybe with TikTok is like the combination of like viral content and AR overlaid. And that's different, perhaps, because I think Apple was more about, I don't know, like building game. It wasn't necessarily about blending video and AR, or it was maybe more about games. Mm. So I'm not sure. I think you're right. Like, maybe it will be an influencer that will do something and it will just go crazy and people will be like, that's cool. As people play with it more, brands can't really ignore that. But I think there's a bit of an uphill mountain to climb, because Apple have had tools out there for almost 3 years, and I don't think AR is the norm right now, much as I think it's cool technology.
Yeah, interesting. And, I mean, I kind of also think that it's possible then that somebody, I suppose it's a little bit like what you've just said there, Gavin, somebody sort of needs to lead the field here. Like you say, AR technology has been out there and available, but not necessarily widely adopted. And so there's a bit of there's a missing piece there somewhere. And what is that missing piece? Is it not being made available in the right platform? And is that what we're going to see here with I was just about to call them TikTok. And I can't, I mean, and now that I've said it out loud, it means I'm just going to carry on calling them TikTok. What do you reckon, Lindsay? A TikTok in a position to potentially lead the field with an AR sort of ad format if they get it right?
I think they could be. I think we run the risk of too easily comparing these different social media platforms as one and the same. And yeah. TikTok is actually very, very different from the likes of Pinterest, the likes of Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram. Even more so in the fact that actually a lot of what TikTok does is almost user regenerated content. So people are using memes and things that other people have already done on TikTok and repeating them to make them better or doing them in different ways. And so I think that the scalability and the shareability, Gavin already mentioned the shareability of TikTok, the shareability first and foremost within its own platform is absolutely huge, because if one person, one influencer does a TikTok video that has a brand AR ad in it and then encourages people to copy it, in the way that TikTok influencers do, that could be absolutely massive. And then, as Gavin just said, the fact that you're able to use and view TikTok content outside the TikTok environment so easily. Like if you view a tweet outside of outside of Twitter, you're often redirected to Twitter. If you try and view a snap outside of Snapchat, you're often redirected to Snapchat. With TikTok, you can view the video there and then whatever, wherever you are. So the fact they've got that right and you can just view an embedded video without being forced to go to TikTok, log in, everything else, means that, that the ability for them to share this and show TikTok as being the ultimate almost winner and leader in AR branding on a social media platform, I think could be really interesting.
And the other thing I was thinking is, let's not forget that, you know, these ad formats are somewhat created as a revenue opportunity, not just for TikTok, but also for those wanting to make revenue off within the platform, right? So including influencers. You know, so because, you know, they're rolling this out with also another ad format that's got a direct call to action button on it. So I guess what they're doing is, you know, just making these formats available. And if they're widely enough adopted and people, and there's a built-in incentivization because people are making money off it, then that's when we could start to see things getting really interesting, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of building a network effect there, because you've got, you know, people who are incentivized to create supply, and that can kind of spiral because of the viral nature of the platform. And that in turn would create an incentive for brands to get involved, and, you know, more and more brands see that and get involved. And it could be that this is the right platform and the right experience for AR to work really well. I'm still a little bit on the fence on it. Yeah. Just because I do think that Apple is a great, you know, we've all got our issues with big tech, and I think we'll talk about it later. But, you know, Apple are very good at kind of making certain behaviors completely common and normal. And they've done it with a lot of different things. I mean, it's crazy to think back to the first iPhone. It didn't have an app store. And now, you know, it's just a ubiquitous thing. Like, everyone knows what app stores are and how they work. Apple Pay, all of these kinds of things. And, you know, they've been at AR for 3 years, and it hasn't yet quite done what I think they thought it would be. I think glass and the idea of wearing something that would superimpose a virtual object into the real world, I think that's really cool. And that you could create amazing brand experiences with that.
Whatever happened to Snapticles?
I've got a pair in my attic. Yeah. I bought a pair a few years ago.
So did we. We bought a couple of pairs, didn't we, Lindsay?
Oh, we did. Oh yeah,
We're in New York when they launched, doing some exchange wire work. There was a couple of us, and Kieran marched us down to the shop, and we all lined up and bought some Snapticals, and then they sat in the corner of pretty much my living room collecting dust.
Mine is sitting in a box in the attic with an old Skybox. I don't know what that says about the technology. But I will say they were less disappointing than Google Glass. I remember trying Google Glass like in 2010 or 11, and I'd seen the adverts, and I was like, this looks amazing, like walking around New York with arrows in the sidewalk telling you where to go. And then I put them on, and I was like, it's a tiny crap TV in the corner of your eye. There's nothing going on over the world. So I'm hoping that Apple are not going to do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I guess it's all about getting it right, having the technology advanced enough but accessible enough for it to be, you know, for it to make sense and for it to actually be a good experience. Let's see what TikTok's got to offer on this front. So news that Axel Springer have submitted a bid to potentially acquire eBay's classifieds business, which is up for sale. So, you know, this is big news in itself, eBay's classified business being up for sale. That's been sort of, commonly known news for some time. Really interesting that Axel Springer are putting a bid forward. They're likely competitors in terms of other interested parties to purchase eBay's classified business is South African e-commerce group called Naspers, and then Norwegian-owned classifieds group called Adventa. These are the guys that own Schibsted and a number of other classified properties across Europe and beyond. And then there's also some interest from a private equity consortium as well. So there's no speculation about what the, you know, what kind of a bid Axel Springer would have put forward and, you know, how likely they are to be successful. But it's interesting because, you know, assessments are that pre-pandemic, this is a business that is potentially worth about $8 to $12 billion. But of course, you know, sort of nearest rivals, eBay's classified business, during the pandemic crisis have had their share prices sort of slide downhill, like many other businesses have too. I'm thinking of the likes of Auto Trader, Rightmove, and carsales.com as well. So I guess what I'm interested to hear from you guys is whether you think this would be a good move for Axel Springer, if you think they've got the heft to do it, because there was news came out last year that US PE firm KKR had invested in Axel Springer. So is it a case that actually they've got significantly deeper pockets than any of us know and understand? And certainly investment from that PE firm will have definitely positioned themselves to be acquisitive, looking for growth. So, you know, is it a play sort of coming from the PE investment side of Axel Springer? And or is it something that could position themselves really in a really strong position from a classifieds point of view? Because they already have some classifieds businesses within the group anyway. I think they've got the recruitment company, I mean, online job portal Stepstone, and then there's another property online site that they've got as well. So is it them trying to increase that side of the business? What in general would it do to their kind of operating power and their position in the European marketplace? Lindsay, what's your perspective on this story?
I think, yeah, I mean, everything you just said about the classifieds business of eBay, I mean, a large portion of that is the auto classifieds business, which no one really knows what's going to happen to it. I mean, obviously, the auto market has taken a huge tumble during the pandemic, and no one really knows how it will rebound, if it will rebound, what that will look like. But there's probably going to be a lot of people wanting to sell their cars after this, when they've been sitting in their driveways or sitting on the road for the past 3 months without being moved. But will there be the market for them to buy? So what will happen to a classifieds business in that sense? But I think the interesting thing is the people that have put their names forward to put the bid in. So you've got this hybrid of PE firms that have come together as one, who tried to buy, it wasn't eBay, it was somebody else, tried to buy them in 2015 and were rejected. Half of them already own half of Auto Scout 24, which is part of the Scout 24 group, which is in competition with eBay Classifieds. And then there's Adventa, which is owned by Shipster, the Scandi company, that owns Spock, which is the boot sale app. And so they already have their own sort of classifieds business. The half the PE firms already kind of invest in those as well. And Axel Springer already have, as you say, Stepstone and Immonet. So actually the classifieds business from eBay coming into that, it's there's this weird almost conglomerate thing happening where these big three sections will own most of the classifieds, and the kind of the Zooplas of the world and all the Autovos of the world will all be owned in mainland Europe by these three sort of either consortia of PE firms, or Schibsted or Axel Springer. And it's a strange one, but I don't know. I mean, I don't really know if eBay class, if it is KKR looking for growth, I'm not necessarily sure that the eBay classifieds business is going to really give them a massive amount of growth. Like eBay Inc. itself is a massively growing business, but eBay Classifieds is a huge business. But I don't know what KKR, if that is the case, which could be an interesting perspective, if the classifieds business would really give it to them. I don't really know if it's a business with a huge opportunity for growth, but maybe it could be. And maybe the classifieds business, particularly in Europe, is so huge that there's massive opportunity here to get themselves against another big publisher house, another big publishing behemoth across Europe as well. So it was a weird mixture of views there, ranting, but
I liked it though. It was the usual sort of Lindsay Roundtree walk through the park of ideas. I liked it.
None of which really meld together, but we'll get there in the end.
I like it. It is an interesting one though, isn't it? Because I was also thinking, you know, that you're right, the verticals within which some of these classifieds businesses are operating, of course, have been challenged during the pandemic. But But the notion of sort of e-commerce businesses and anything online has certainly grown in popularity in a general capacity. So actually, you know, would we see some growth in these businesses in a sort of general sense, suddenly people thinking about them in ways that they haven't done before, or people shopping in that way, or procuring products in that way, online, I mean, where they haven't ever thought about doing that before. But then at the tail end of the pandemic, you've kind of got this recession potentially coming in off the top of it as well. So are we just going to see a bit of a reduction in profitability across most sectors and most businesses? So I don't know. I've got some mixed thoughts about that. Gavin, what's your point of view?
I mean, I think so. Just, you know, when you look at the classified businesses that Axel Springer already have, it seems to be sort of fairly heavily concentrated around jobs and property. And I definitely think eBay's classifieds business offers quite a bit more diversification into other areas. Obviously, auto is a big part. I don't really know how eBay's classifieds business breaks out, but I do know as a user of something like Gumtree, like, you can find anything on there, from, you know, from the crap of the day to cars to furniture to whatever. And actually, you know, I reckon probably a good amount of the stuff on somewhere like Gumtree is probably recession-proof. Obviously, cars and lockdown do not mix well, neither does property, and neither probably do jobs. But I think all of these other things are things that probably, as long as you're not breaking a lockdown rule, people are looking for a bargain and they do still need stuff in their houses. So the other interesting thing is I was looking at Axel Springer. I think I've got about 300 million users globally. And I suspect, aside from some of their news titles, like Insider and Politico and Rolling Stone, a lot of their users are going to be inside kind of German-speaking countries on a lot of their properties. eBay Classifieds has got 250 million users globally. So there's potentially quite a big footprint of additional users that they would be acquiring there. And obviously, there's then going to be opportunities in terms of potentially, you know, driving traffic between brands, growing brands in new markets. You know, so I think it looks like quite an interesting thing from Axel Springer's perspective as they, you know, further build out this big media conglomerate. The bit that I don't get, and I never get this with companies, like, you know, there was comment in one of the articles that I read about this where it said, you know, how are they going to find a bank that's going to, you know, underwrite this, or, you know, is it going to be financed through debt? Like, how come one company can make it work when they can layer on so much debt onto it that the business becomes much more expensive to run than it is for eBay to run it right now, where they don't have that debt? Like, and you've got activist investors who are driving for that to be sold. Like, why aren't they driving for it to be run more efficiently if that's what somebody else sees $10 billion of value in? I don't know. It feels like one of these kind of, from an eBay perspective, and I'm sure eBay maybe aren't delighted about being pushed into selling big chunks of their business. It just feels like a relatively short-term thing that, you know, it will inject some cash into the business, it will boost the share price, some activist investors will make some cash, and then they'll move on.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, without being an investment banker, so clearly not at all qualified to answer that question, you raise some really interesting points there. I mean, firstly, it's that eBay, as you rightly point out, are being pressured into selling this part of the business by their own investors. And then secondly, how do the sums actually stack up? So therefore, what is it that any potential buyer is looking at within the eBay classifieds business that's going to bring them extra value? And that then makes the question of why Axel Springer is interested in them even more interesting, because is it those users that you're talking about and that user data? Because as you've just sort of painted that picture, it reminds me that we, you know, we're all pretty familiar with Axel Springer's narrative about how important they think user data is within their own business, and the power and heft that they intend to pack around their users in terms of logged in data and user profiles, and also their very strong opinions about the dominance of, you know, US ad tech companies that are self-interested in that ecosystem. So, you know, is this a play of Axel looking for something that gives them additional users in an environment where they know it's going to be, they're going to be able to identify those users, it's going to give them a lot of good first-party data, or rather is it an investment transaction as you describe, where investors are seeing some kinds of value that will give them a dividend in the short term. Let's not worry about the long term. I don't know. That's what makes it so interesting, right? And also too, it's whatever it ends up being, even if it doesn't hit the monetary value that was anticipated prior to the pandemic, it's still going to be a really big deal, right? Yeah.
Logged in data is quite a good point as well there. I mean, if you are buying logged in users, 250 million of them, there's stuff you can do with that once Chrome makes the changes that it's got coming in the not too distant future. And if you look across, you know, all of the actual Springer properties, they potentially have got, I don't know, it's somewhere between 300 and 550 million users globally.
Which makes it very strong.
That's a big footprint, and there's a lot you can do with that.
Totally. Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, we've had eBay Classifieds on stage at HS Berlin a couple of times, and the stuff they and they are, as a publisher, they are, you know, they're doing some really interesting things, and Gavin mentioning stuff around identity and what that could look like. I think they're in a really good position to be able to take advantage of that with the first party data they've got access to. And I also really agree with what Gavin said about the fact that actually, and this could tie in, Rachel, with your theory about KKR, this gives Axel Springer, where Business Insider kind of has, but maybe also hasn't, because it's mostly B2B focused, the chance to get out of their stronghold in Germany and give themselves more of a global footprint, not just focused on this massive European powerhouse, which they absolutely are, they're huge, but they're not known really outside of that realm. I spoke to somebody about this article, and they said to me, "Who's Axel Springer?" And I was like, "What do you mean, who is Axel Springer? How have you not heard of them?"
I think we know them really well in ad tech circles, just because, you know, they're the ones who did stuff with AppNexus, and, you know,
that's right.
You know, like, they're very well known in the ad tech space, but in the wider B2C space, they're not.
Well, what's more concerning is this person was in ad tech, but they weren't, admittedly, they weren't in Europe. Right. And that for me was interesting. They weren't in Europe and they were like, "I don't know who you're talking about." Like, okay, fine.
Well, I hope they were very far away from Europe, Lindsay, to make that point of view credible.
It doesn't really. I still believe they should have known them. I was still totally. Like, even so, you should have, they should be on your radar somewhere, somehow. But I won't judge them. It's absolutely
anonymous
fine.
Person in ad tech who doesn't know Axel Springer.
Exactly. But yeah, I do agree. I think that this kind of international foothold, which I do believe is something KKR would be wanting to get a hold of, it would be very interesting for them.
Because sorry, Lindsay, I didn't mean to cut across. I was just thinking, because otherwise, why was KKR interested in Axel, in investing in Axel Springer in the first instance? Anyway, I think these stories are literally just written to enable people like us to sit around and pontificate about what might or might not happen next. They're pretty interesting.
We'll probably find that Axel are dropped from the process unceremoniously next week.
Totally.
And it goes to a bunch of PE companies who just want to asset strip it.
Exactly.
And all of our theories about logged in for 250 million users in the bin.
Yeah, how disappointing. I hope someone from Axel Springer is listening to this thinking,
we should form a conglomerate and put a bid in. I don't know if we're too late.
Not a bad idea. I mean, you know, ExchangeWise is a tidy little company, but I'm not sure we've got deep enough pockets.
No.
Not yet, anyway. Any day now, though.
Yeah.
Right. So moving on to third story of the week, I wanted to touch on a good summary article that came out on Axios earlier on this week, trying to pull together a point of view on the various antitrust investigations and potential lawsuits coming forward to Google, Facebook, certainly Amazon. I think Apple might have been scooped up in one of them. Over in the US. So the notion behind this piece was to say that, and we have talked about, you know, pretty much at least a couple of these cases that I'm going to note specifically on the MadTech podcast over the last 12 months. There's been a lot of activity happening in the US around anti-competition associated with these big tech companies. And quite a bit of that activity is due to come to some sort of a conclusion within the next couple of months. So these are investigations that have been ongoing for nearly a year in most instances. Investigations that they note, which I find particularly interesting, is that the DOJ are preparing actually to bring a case forward against Google for their sort of practices in ad tech specifically. under an anti-competition banner. And so they're really at the very end of their investigations and are looking forward to bring, well, they might be looking forward to it, who knows? They're looking to bring forward a lawsuit accusing Google of anti-competitive behaviour in ad tech. The House Judiciary Committee, which is a sort of a more junior committee to some of the big name committees that we hear a lot about, but they still wield a lot of power, are expected to conclude their investigations into Google, Facebook, Amazon and Apple and their position in general in digital marketplaces, and that's expected to be concluded in the next couple of months. And it's thought that legislation is going to follow from that. So, you know, obviously there's no comment on what the conclusions are likely to be at the moment, but it's keenly anticipated that that committee is specifically drafting not just recommendations but suggested legislation that they want to see passed after these investigations are made public, and then, or the outcome of the investigations made public. And then the FTC has been for some time looking at Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp and Instagram, again, under competition rules. And I find that particularly interesting, you know, considering that Facebook are still busy acquiring companies and they're just about to go through the process of acquisition for Giphy. What I thought was interesting about this summary article is it puts a position forward that even though we're in the midst of a global crisis, the wheels of sort of legislative investigation are still rolling along, and there's a lot of anticipation and expectation that these investigations will actually yield something. And it's quite possible that there are a number of politicians and various other people in the US who've got some significant interest in these cases that are not going to let them drop. And the thought is that it's still going to be quite a difficult year for a lot of these companies under the banner of anti-competition and regulation. I'm interested to know what you guys think of this, whether you think there's going to be, you know, are we actually going to see something come out of some of these investigations? I know it's very hard to tell because it's purely speculative at this stage. But if we do see something come out of these investigations, what do you think it's likely to be? Are we going to see some legislative sort of controls put in place? And if we are, where within these businesses do you think they might fall? Will it be about restricting how these businesses operate? Will it be specifically focusing on competition and what the sort of threshold for consideration needs to be when companies are looking to acquire other companies, and whether that puts some kind of anti-competition cloud over the acquisition? And I'm also interested to know if you think any of this is really actually going to have some impact on the day-to-day machinations of working in the advertising technology industry. Gavin?
Yeah, I mean, so there were lots of questions there, so I'm going to try and remember as many as I can.
That's a classic Rachel Smith compound question.
I feel a little bit like a politician being grilled in some select committee.
Oh, yeah, all the gardens of number 10 Downing Street. I'd be very happy to roll up there and ask a few questions.
And I haven't been scribbling notes, so I don't have all your questions there. I think it's difficult to know what will happen. I mean, you know, lots of people have speculated about things that could happen, like, could these companies be forced to break up and sell off bits of them? You know, that when you look at companies like Google and Facebook, that's tricky because in every area that they operate in, they are quite dominant. And whether that be search or whether it be ad serving or whether it be their DSP or their exchange, like, even shedding off some of it will still leave them in a position where they have still got a very dominant part of a very large industry. And it's not like they're going to get rid of the biggest bits. They're going to get rid of maybe, I don't know, I'm sure there would be people at Google who have planned out a roadmap where bits of stuff moves off, like YouTube might be an easy thing to kind of carve off as a standalone business. So it's difficult to know if legislatures will go down that carving them up route, or whether, you know, if you look at the CMA in the UK have kind of suggested that there might be some things that can happen, like Google being more open in terms of search and opening up data out of search, or Facebook more readily integrating with other platforms. So, it could be that they're forced to open up APIs, open up data. I don't know how you open up more data with GDPR and other data things going on all around the world. It does feel like something's going to happen. Like, there has been a groundswell for quite a while. I think within the industry, people have seen and felt the rise of these behemoths over the last decade. And I think legislators over, I don't know, the last 5, 6, 7 years. And I think the general public, I mean, with things like Cambridge Analytica, you know, these things have hit consumers' attention as well, you know, the behavior of big tech. So it's difficult to know where it will go, but it does feel like something will happen. And, it, you know, it's not just happening in the US, it's happening in the UK, it's happening in Australia, it's happening all over the world. And then, you know, it's funny as well, because even up to like the present day, I mean, overnight, Trump has, you know, made noises about his displeasure at Twitter badging his tweets, and has said that he might amend something that's currently, I think, in process, which would not protect the social platforms from freedom of speech from the content that's on their site, which, you know, would have pretty big implications for Facebook. I think it would have some for Google as well. So, like, it's a very quickly evolving landscape. You also asked about, like, just things keeping on moving with the pandemic going on. I mean, I think a lot of the people who will be involved in looking into the practices of ad tech companies are not people who add value to how we solve the pandemic. So these things, I mean, it's a little bit like businesses may not be advertising as much as they are today, but there's lots of good housekeeping you can do in the background and looking at your tech stack and whatever, optimizing pre-bid, doing this, doing that. Governments have still got teams of people who can work on reviews of industries, and that will continue. Maybe the action won't happen until the pandemic is much more under control, but the investigative work behind it will continue.
And that's a really interesting point, actually, Gavin. I'll come to you in a second, Lindsay. But there is some speculation, if we think about what might be the outcome of some of these investigations. What I personally would find very disappointing is if some of them fizzled out into settlements, which is a possibility. We've already seen that happen. We've seen that happen in Europe. And the reason I'd find that disappointing is because we're talking about tech companies that can probably well and truly easily afford to pay a big sum figure without it actually changing anything about the way that they run and organise their business. And the speculation that maybe, you know, legislators might go for that if there's certain political pressures to get things done before the election, and tech companies might be in favour of that because they might feel that some, you know, politicians on one side of the fence will be more in favour of the way they operate their business than others. And then I started to think, well, will the election go ahead in November? And if it doesn't, if it's postponed, then maybe that might have an impact on how these sort of judgments fall and what action is brought forward. Lindsay?
Yeah, I think, I mean, first of all, I can't avoid the hilarious irony about Trump talking about levelling out based on the blue badge that's been put on his tweet when he's the one who apparently invented fake news. the whole thing is just absolutely ridiculous. But I think that there's some interesting things here. And you've both talked about what has happened in Europe so far and the fact that obviously there have been fines levelled out. I think Google have received 3 fines over the past few years from the EU, which have resulted in settlements, but they've been in the billions, and to the average consumer, you'd go, that's a vast sum of money. Hopefully Google changes their ways, but Google just pay it off and carry on as normal. And I think that whatever happens in the US, be it from the Justice Department, the DOJ, the FTC, and all the state attorneys, whatever happens, I think there's going to be a bit of a mob mentality because all 4 of them are still forging ahead with their own litigation, their own cases against these big tech companies. I think that for most people that think that all these companies have broken up, whatever they do won't be enough. And Elizabeth Warren's always talked about breaking up Google and saying they should divest Waze and Nest and DoubleClick. And if you say that Google need to get rid of Nest, then arguably Amazon should get rid of Ring. And there are still millions out there that have no idea that Amazon even own Ring, which is another interesting thing. But I think that the divestiture, I don't think it will happen, but I think it's what needs to happen. There's the argument around if you demand behavioural changes versus structural changes, actually, do the behavioural changes even do anything? If you're giving them a slap on the wrist and saying, stop doing that, you're very naughty, behave yourself, they'll go, yeah, I'm really sorry, I promise I won't do it again. And then they'll go around and do it again and find a way that you can't discover what they're doing. Whereas if you structurally enforce these things, then maybe that will be what needs to happen. And then, and even if it's not to every single of the big tech companies, but to one of them, to just kind of, I guess, look at them as a scapegoat. I think that's what probably a lot of people will think needs to happen, because clearly the fines aren't really doing anything, or the fines are too small to really be levelled out as having any real change. But I did read somewhere as well that actually there is someone that says that it can take 10 years for a big fine like that to actually be seen to be having any impact on that company. And of course there's the aspect of, if you are given a big fine, and I naively assumed that these lawsuits that were going on would be kind of calmed down during the pandemic. And Gavin, as you said, actually there are still plenty of people out there that can work on these cases and they can still forward them ahead. That might be to a lesser capacity or a slower capacity because of the pandemic, but they can still go ahead with them, so that the tech companies will be prepared for that. But the having to focus on fines will mean that the senior leaders in these companies will have their eyes off the ball when it comes to doing what the company needs to be doing, and be focusing more on litigation and anything else, and trying to get their lawyers involved. But there was the example of, I think it was when Microsoft were fined by the US back in the 50s. They say that fine back in the 50s actually paved the way for Google to be what it is now. So actually, it could take decades for what we conceive to be a small fine against Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, could actually down the line have a fundamental impact on actually allowing new market entrants that we wouldn't even conceive possible looking at how small these fines are today. So I don't know. It's very, again, one of my classic, it's like the Rachel Compound question. It's the Lindsay just go off on a million tangents at once.
I liked it. But also, I wondered if that was that Microsoft fine in the 50s? I sort of feel like it was in the 80s, but maybe this is all got 80, to do with age.
You said 50s. I thought I heard 50s. I was like,
50s. No.
The 50s.
50s. Yeah, 50s.
I'm quite sure Microsoft weren't quite the business they are now.
I think Bill Gates was probably 5 years old in the 50s as well. I don't think he maybe founded Microsoft in the 50s when he was a toddler. But,
it took 55 years for the fine to have effect and pave a path for Google, but it happened.
But you're totally right. 80s. Yeah, 80s. You're totally right about that, though, Lindsay, 100%. I mean, that's, you know, it's a well-made point that actually some of these things just serve to frustrate and distract the leaders of big organisations sufficiently that it just creates a chasm, I suppose, and in the meantime, other smaller, more innovative companies get their act together and work their way up into a credible competitor. Maybe that's what's going to happen. Did you have a final point there? I didn't mean to cut across you with your.
I don't know what it was. So
I do wonder if the same thing would happen, though, in that my suspicion is that Microsoft in the 50s or the 80s was a slightly less complex company than Google, in that they just shipped operating systems. Google is a lot more complex and there are hooks between every single bit of it. Breaking them up, finding them is, I don't know, like, they're bigger and they can probably absorb bigger fines than Microsoft back then.
They probably have it in their P&L, like, let's put a few billion aside for fines each year.
I am 100% sure there will be reserve accounts in a number of big tech companies for this. I was going to make another point and I've completely, my other point was, because of the complexity, the other barrier, I think, to like meaningful change happening here is that these are not changes that will come around quickly. And politicians typically tend not to focus on very long-term problems because they can't fix them in the term that they're in. And when the political axis kind of swings back to, when it goes from Tory to Labour back, or in the US from Republicans to Democrats, like, these things lose momentum because people change and strategies change, and I don't know, like, that could well result in, like, the things that are happening right now may well be gathering steam. If the Democrats were to win at the end of the year, they could all lose steam. It's hard to say, but the rewards for politicians in damaging a large company that does pay, in the US at least, decent amounts of tax, the benefit in the short term is not huge for them versus just leaving it alone, because they're not actually going to be able to fix it potentially in their term.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of weird incentives that go on around the space and outside the space that have an effect on us.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, again, you know, you raised some good points. They're big taxpayers in the US. They're not anywhere else, which is, you know, as far as I can tell, a bit of a crime, really, and a crime that they might not themselves be 100% responsible for. They're simply availing themselves of said loopholes. You know, I think that there surely can't be anything more stark than the current crisis that we're going through for European governments to sit back and think, maybe we need to review some of our tax loopholes because we need as much money as we can possibly get through the door right now. Yeah. So, you know, I know that's a complex, issue with a complex set of pressures involved in it, but ultimately these companies should pay more tax.
As you say, it's not their fault. I mean, governments very deliberately create the ability for a loophole to exist to make themselves attractive. You know, the Netherlands and Ireland are good examples of European countries that have just played a game to attract investment.
Yeah.
And why shouldn't you take advantage of that if it's legal?
Yeah. And, you know, and so therefore when it comes to tax contributions, it's backfired enormously, right? I was wondering, you know, on the point that you made that, you know, perhaps Microsoft was a slightly more simple company in terms of the way it was constructed and perhaps even its sort of product suite than say Google is today or various other big tech companies. Maybe that's in part what's behind some of the legislators in the US, you know, given that most of them, as you also say, are probably not focused on the long term, but rather the short term. For the few that might be focused on the long term, maybe what they're thinking about is where will be this multiplicity of companies in a marketplace that could all be paying tax and contributing and hiring people. And it's all good and well to see, you know, companies the likes of Amazon grow and thrive and set up offices in places where they employ thousands and thousands of people. But if they're the only employer in town, what happens when something goes wrong there, or, you know, when the balance of power shifts somehow, that means that you've got, you know, most of your eggs in just a couple of baskets? Shouldn't there be a multiplicity marketplace? And I'd have thought that's what the classic American sort of, you know, capitalist system was set up for, actually. Less about the sort of equality within that system, because we all know it's not equal, but more about the opportunity for lots and lots of competitors to thrive instead of just a few.
But that's, I mean, it's interesting as well because, you know, Facebook just made that Shops announcement this week, and you know, that's about partly enabling what you talk about, which is providing a tool for, a husband and wife or whoever to like set up a shop from home and get started. But at the same time, that's also empowering big tech and further reducing multiplicity in the market. Like, it's a tricky one. Like, it's a really complex question. I don't know that I've got anything particularly smart to say about it. It just seems to be one of those things in the world. Like, capitalism does seem to be about, you know, if you want to go and do something, go and do it, and if there's a market for it, you'll make money. But at the same time, capitalism also seems to be right now about, you know, big business, and big business at the expense of everything else. That seems to be happening all over the world.
Yeah, you're right. Well, we could carry on down that road, but let's move to the second part of the podcast and focus a little bit on what you've been up to, Gavin. You're somewhat a man of leisure. That might be maybe a bit too rich a description, since no one's having that much leisure at the moment. not that there isn't opportunities to, but there's nowhere to go and enjoy that leisure time, is there?
Well, I don't know. I've got a hot tub in the back garden. I'll be in it in about 25 minutes.
Okay, this is what happens in the suburbs of London. Is that where you're living, Gavin? Yeah, good. Love it. Okay, so when you're not in your hot tub, what else have you been up to lately?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that I thought would be interesting for us to chat about was like this continuation of what we were talking about. And I guess the challenges that ad tech as a whole, and whether that's, you know, big tech companies like GAFA, or even whether it's kind of the mid tail of ad tech or the long tail, you know, it feels like it's a pretty challenging environment for companies to operate in right now. If you're one of the big guys, you definitely you're in the crosshairs of a number of different governments who are doing things like, you know, looking at anti-competitive behavior, antitrust. You know, the Australian government published some initial findings, I think, at the back end of last year and has made some initial suggestions on next steps. The CMA in the UK has been talking to people across the industry through last year. And we've obviously got all of these things going on in the US. On top of that, you know, we've got lots of other things going on. We've got the pandemic, and that is obviously having an effect on ad spend, and that's a tricky thing for any company to deal with. And potentially, if there's a recession that follows and how long it takes to get out of that, that's going to be difficult for companies. And then I think there's a lot of other lenses that people are looking at ad tech through right now to try and figure out like how to make sure that they're getting the most from it. Brands right now have obviously got a very strong focus on the transparency of the supply chain, and that is going to create pressures in the future. The PwC ISPA report in the UK that came out, I don't know,
I think it's 3 weeks.
That report just creates doubt. And, you know, whether the suggestions that have been in various press titles are correct or not, and there has been a lot of nonsense spoken, I think, by some people about dirty secrets that ad tech are hiding. But it does create doubt because there is discrepancies through the value chain. Some of that probably will be tech related, and most of it, I think, will be unintentional. And there may be a few bits and pieces in there. But ultimately, where it's probably going to lead to is a need for potentially complete transparency on fees. And one thing that we do know is that once you're transparent on fees, they don't go up. They typically go down at that point. So we've got kind of that going on top of those other things that I just mentioned. And then there's a million different brand safety things going on. And it's not just happening from like the brand side. Like, governments are looking at other angles where ad tech is playing a role. The UK government has looked at the role that advertising plays on journalism and the funding of democratic access to quality journalism. They've also looked at the role that advertising plays in funding copyrighted content breaches, so advertising and torrent websites. They've looked at the role that advertising plays in child sexual abuse websites. All of these things happening once, I think, just... It's a really interesting time, but it's also a really difficult time, I think.
And do you, from the sort of conversations that you've been involved in, you know, over, let's say, the last 12 months, and maybe some of the sort of government, either sort of organisations or sort of bodies that have been pulled together to look at some of this activity, are you getting an impression that we're making some progress as an industry, or and in fact, are we in a position at the moment which is similar to the one we just described with regards to some of the investigations happening in the US, that there's a few things happening at once and creating a little bit of a maelstrom around this part of the industry? Are we on the cusp of starting to see some significant change? Are we going to, you know, some of these investigations and some of the government sort of, viewpoints going to actually change the way the industry is operating?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I'm not going to name specific initiatives just because I'm going to say a couple of things about them. Like, one of the initiatives which I thought was really interesting and had a lot of value completely ground to a halt when there were political changes that happened. So this kind of links back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, the incentives for politicians or maybe even just the personal goals of specific politicians who will shine a spotlight, but when they move on to something else, that spotlight just gets dropped. So, you know, there's definitely been a bit of that. I do think there are things, I mean, I think like the Cairn Cross Review was looking at, it wasn't specifically looking at ad tech. It was looking more into democratic access to the news and the importance of that to, you know, the public. And ad tech was just one part of that. I think that is something that will go on because it has a wider agenda. And ad tech is just kind of caught up in it. And ad tech is caught up in it rightly because ad tech provide a meaningful revenue stream to the big news companies. So I think, like, there will be things that will, there are things going on right now that will have a meaningful effect on our tech. Ultimately, I think the things that can have the greatest effect are the things that come from within, not within the industry, but within the value chain. Ultimately, advertisers decide where their money goes. And I think advertisers and agencies are therefore the most powerful groups in terms of being able to affect change, because they can just make a decision and go, do you know what? If this doesn't happen, we're not going to put money there. Mm. And very quickly, people will change their behavior. Mm. Publishers arguably can do the same because they control supply. And they could also say, I won't give my supply to somebody unless ABC. So I do think we're kind of moving to that place where the people at either end, the advertisers with the money and the needs and the publishers with the audience, are starting to become more strong in terms of, you know, we feel like we're not getting the best deal. And whether that's right or wrong, there's that perception is there and it needs to be addressed. And I think we're going to see some fairly fundamental changes because of that.
And that's an interesting point, because do you feel that everybody's participating proactively in that conversation? So are advertisers and brands coming into that conversation, willingly? I'm quite sure some are, but I'm just saying from a sort of mainstream point of view, are brands and advertisers starting to view this transaction from a slightly different angle and thinking, whether or not they believe that they've got the power, I'm sure they would agree that their main purpose is to sell their products, right? But are they starting to think of it from the point of view of we need to feel confident about this entire transaction, though, because it's not just about where our brand appears and how we sell products. It's also about how this industry, you know, continues to operate. And it's also about how, publishers monetize their business, which is not just about providing advertising opportunities. It's also about paying journalists, arguably.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think brands care about it and are more involved than they've ever been. You know, the PwC report was done with ISBA, which is the trade body for advertisers in the UK. The WFA, the World Federation of Advertisers, has currently got the GARM initiative, the Global Alliance for Responsible Media. I sat in that group when I was at OpenX, and there were 70 or 80 global heads of media sitting in that meeting. So, you know, from the largest companies in the world, the Unilevers, the PMGs, the BPs, Nestle's. So, you know, they are getting more vocal than they have ever been, and quite rightly, because, you know, the optics of all of the data that comes from these reports suggest that there is more of a spotlight that's needed to be shown. That's just the optics. It doesn't mean that there is stuff in there, but definitely if you read some of the things that have been said, I mean, it sounds like ad tech people are walking away from the scene with a bag of money over their shoulder, which is definitely not the case. I mean, you know that aside from big tech, you know, ad tech companies do not find life particularly easy right now, and haven't done for a while. It's not like the good old days back in the noughties when, you know, margins were high and expenses bills were high and ad tech was really, really fun. I mean, it's a different fun now. It's more intellectually challenging, but it's not the same business that it used to be. So I suspect that when brands do shine more of a spotlight, they're going to find that it's not as bad as maybe they thought it was going to be. They'll find things that do need to be tidied up and where there does need to be more transparency.
That's really interesting. Lindsay, putting you on the spot a bit, but I just wonder if some of the sort of conversations you feel that you've had with people over the last 12 months at ATS panels and maybe other panels that you've moderated in other events, does that mirror some of what, some of what Gavin's reporting there that, and I know you're always involved in a range of discussions across both the buy and sell side. Are we seeing an industry where both sides are kind of caring a little bit more about everything that's going on? And, you know, as Gavin says, the ad tech industry has changed a lot. And is it the case that actually maybe there's not I'm paraphrasing. I'm not saying this is what you were saying, Gavin, but, you know, maybe there's not as much nefarious behaviour as there once was, because everybody's focusing in on things a little more tightly. And the debate is centering around how everyone gets paid for the job that they're doing and how everyone gets best value out of it. So are we seeing that conversation shift, or would you say that the conversations, particularly around things like transparency and maybe even fees and margins, are still the same now that they were 12, 18 months ago?
I think from the conversations I've been having, they definitely still exist. And that changes market by market. Like, you speak to, I think it's when we were doing ATS Stockholm back in February, before when we were allowed to travel still, I think talking to one of the agencies that was head of Nordics and said, Denmark, all they care about is transparency. Like, literally, that's the only thing that crosses their mind. But they couldn't care about it at all in Norway. I, that might not be the correct markets, but it was interesting that it differs on a market by market basis. But I think also it was only a few short years ago where the report came out saying that everything that not just the tech vendors are doing, but agencies are doing, was completely nefarious and nobody could be trusted and advertisers were terrified. And a lot has happened since then, a lot good and a lot bad. And we're nowhere near in the position we were in back then. And that was global. That was due a time we were buying Snapticles, actually. We were in New York having a conversation on stage and the agencies were saying, you know, our advertisers don't trust us. How do we change this? And we're having the same conversation in London, in Singapore. And it was a global phenomenon that every advertiser thought that they were being hoodwinked. And thankfully, I don't believe that's the case anymore. And I think that agencies have had to work really hard to try to regain a lot of trust from the advertisers they work with. And a lot of that has gone down to, has been with them having more transparent and frank conversations with the tech vendors they work with too, and trying to build more better direct relationships with publishers as well, because the more and more tech coming in meant that those relationships were getting a little bit weaker. And it's only helped to fuel that. And you think back to kind of the famous speech that Mark Pritchard gave at the IAB Leadership Summit, that was quoted 15 million times, and it was probably one of the most talked about names in ad tech. That we are, I do believe we're a long way from that. There's still a hell of a lot to be done. And the ISBA report, you know, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the ISBA report could go some way to making that take a step back a bit, because it makes it look like advertisers believe that ad tech is just dark art, which actually isn't true. You speak to many advertisers, they don't believe that, but there is still work that needs to be done, that they want to feel like they can understand everything that's been talked about. They're not just being met with a bunch of jargon. And if they, you know, if they ask for a log file report, they're not going to get laughed at. And also, they have the capability of being able to ask for a log file report and understand what the hell's in it.
What it means.
Understand what's in it, rather than think, saying, well, I've been told I should be asking for this, so I'm going to ask for it and freak my agency out. But then everyone just goes, you don't know what, do you have any idea what is involved in this document? So I think there's still a lot of that, a lot of kind of playing to the rough against each other, but it's just so different from what it was a few years ago, where it really was quite a scary time, actually. If you think back, it was quite a scary time that actually the trust was eroded across the entire supply chain.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Does that seem familiar to you, Gavin, as well? Does that feel like a similar trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, for the last, I mean, it's now just over 20 years that I've been in digital, which is terrifying. But for that entire time, there has always been stuff going on.
Straight out of high school, yeah?
Yeah. No. Did a couple of years before that somewhere else. So, you know, there's always been stuff going on. And I think there's always been stuff reported in the press that the industry's up to. I always remember, you know, the early stuff was typically about bad ad placement. You know, it would not be unusual for the front page of the trade press to be a screen grab of like a mobile phone company's ad in Napster. That would be the ad of the time. And Napster at that point was a P2P, is that right? File sharing app that we all downloaded our MP3s from and listened to them in the office. You know, and there's been stories about, you know, rebates, and there's been stories about people taking money off the table and high margins. And, you know, we've gone through data stories. We've had in the US, I think, have the FBI or been looking at potentially investigating like fraudulent behavior on behalf of in agencies over the last couple
yes,
of years?
Yes, I believe there was something referred over to the FBI, yeah.
So like there's been a lot of stuff that's happened. I do think the industry has grown up a lot. I think a lot of the bad actors that were there don't exist anymore, because a lot of the controls that exist up and down the value chain make it much more difficult to be nefarious. I don't think every bad player is gone. I think there's probably still some out there, because there always will be. I think things are getting better, and I think it's always important to remember, like, advertisers aren't stupid. They use ad tech because it drives value. You know, I've seen some speculators over the last couple of weeks say, you know, why don't advertisers just go back to the days of buying media direct from publishers? And you're like, okay, right. Firstly, who's going to make all the phone calls to make that happen? And then do you have an ad server? And then you quite like viewability. Have you got? And very quickly, you rebuild programmatic to pretty much where it is right now. You know, ad tech does drive a lot of value, and advertisers know that. I think advertisers just want to feel like they have a way of making sure that everything's working as they were told it should. And that feels like a reasonable request.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is a really interesting conversation. We could go on, but we've well and truly run out of time. So I'm gonna cap it off there. But safe to say, Gavin, thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to hearing what you're up to next and having you back, quite frankly, when you move on to your next thing after you've spent a bit of time in the hot tub.
Yep. Hot tub barbecue beer.
And Gavin's afternoon.
Yeah.
Jealous. Thanks very much, Gavin. Thanks, Lindsay. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.